Tonight it's a real pleasure to welcome Kina Leski, who has written this remarkable book, The Storm of Creativity. If I were only going to buy one book about creativity, this would be it. It really is a remarkable book, and I was telling Kina I probably have about 10 linear feet of shelf space devoted to the concept of creativity. Kina is a professor of architecture at the Rhode Island School of Design. She's a founding member of 360 Architecture. She's an actor, an artist, and a writer. She authored the first semester core architecture design curriculum that's used at RISD, the Rhode Island School of Design, for 17 years, and a book was published in 2007, The Making of Design Principles. She has spoken about the creative process throughout the United States and abroad, and gave a main stage presentation at PopTech in 2009. In 1997, the Architectural League of New York selected her as one of its five winners of its annual Young Architects Competition. And in 2000, she was nominated for a Chrysler Design Award. Her design she calls Dream House, and it was awarded first place in the Shinkansiku Residential Design Competition in 1998. She has served as the City Architect Design Decision Review Advisor to the Mayor of Providence. And I would ask before Kina comes up, please silence your cell phones and try to refrain from texting for the next hour. Thank you. Please welcome Kina Leski.
Thank you, Jerry. What a blast it is to get a email from an oceanographer who's interested in storms and creativity to invite me out here to California. That is why I wrote this book, was to try and make connections with people who know a lot more than I do about some of the things that I'm writing. So this is a real treat. And thank you for coming. So I'm gonna start right in. This is the book, Storm of Creativity, by answering the question, what is creativity? What is it to me? And what is included? What I mean by creativity is anything that is created that's new. And that could be a thing, or it could be an idea or a thought, or even the recognition of something that exists that wasn't recognized before. But it doesn't mean production of anything, of stuff. Like the aspect in anything that's produced that is a new thought for us is what I think is a creative act. But that also means that what's included is basically any field. I don't think that there are only certain fields that you could say are creative fields. It could be science, it could be art, it could be really anything. And that's the perspective that I took with this writing and my research. So I use the metaphor of a storm to describe catalytic phases in the creative process. And I mean the meteorological storm. I don't mean the use of the word storm that Alex Fackney Osborne used after World War II when he coined the term brainstorm. He was actually referring to the military use of the word storm, this idea of a barrage of ideas, known information thrown at a problem. I actually see it very differently in terms of the meteorological storm. So, for me, this is a little animation I made, which is the way I think, that a storm and creativity appear to start from nothing, but they in fact start from a disturbance. And through that disturbance, there's a kind of negative pressure that's created that produces this kind of gathering up, fueling from its situation or environment that then manages to get organized and propel it forward. Both storm and creativity have a cyclical nature. They have unclear boundaries. They're contagious. One creative act can affect or produce another. As is one storm, it's hard to decide where it actually ends and another one begins. And the point of view I'm taking is the eye of the storm. And that means that you're within it. And that's the point of view I take through this. And you're also the producer of it. But it's something that is also happening at vast scales. You could just have a small little rain shower or something that's very vast and has great destructive properties as well, potentially. But it's something that it may not last, it continues through the hydrologic cycle, so it does continue, and it does have this contagious capacity as well. I'm not the only one thinking about storms and creativity. The neuroscientist David Eagleman spoke about the massive lightning storms that take place within the mind, within the brain. All our lives, our cognition, our thoughts, beliefs, all of these are underpinned by these massive lightning storms or electrical storms in our brains. And what's interesting about this is that here we have this neuroscientist, David Eagleman, wearing a vest that he created with a graduate student that enables a deaf person to hear. Because, okay. This vest has sensors on the back that pick up sound and then give a stimulus to the person wearing it so that those stimulus gets translated into electrical signals so that you hear. And what was interesting in this lecture is that David Eagleman was wearing it underneath his shirt. At the end, he took off his shirt to show you the vest. And the crowd applauded. And he felt something, because he never felt applause before coming through his body. So it really showed this sense of being within the storm, that there's this activity that produces something that then is brought into the world, that then can come back and you can inhabit it again. That boundary is not clear, that you're on the cusp of the inside of the outside, the innate knowledge and the learned knowledge. But it also made me think of this quote by, I have a microphone, right, so I can walk around. So I'm going to do that, so I can read my, I'm going to go out in the audience. So this makes me think of this poem by Walt Whitman. All architecture is what you do when you look upon it. Did you think it was in the white or gray stone or in the lines of the arches and cornices? All music is what awakens from you when you're reminded by the instruments. It is not the violins and the cornets. It is not the oboe, not the beating drums, nor the score of the baritone singer singing his sweet romanza, nor that of the men's chorus, nor that of the women's chorus. It is neither and farther than they. And so this is the storm's eye view that I'm trying to take in this writing and in this book. Again, I'm not a scholar. I'm more of somebody as an artist, as a designer, as a daughter of an architect, daughter of an actor, inhabiting and sensing what the phenomena is, what the catalytic stages are of the process. So the first stage that I write about, although I think these can happen in various orders, is unlearning. And I think this is, for me, is the most important one. And unlearning is about that disturbance. And it's basically a disturbance of something that you thought you knew that you actually find that you don't know upon scrutiny. It produces a kind of negative insight, as the physicist Murray Gell-Mann spoke about. A successful new theoretical idea typically alters and extends the existing body of theory to allow for observational facts that cannot be previously understood or incorporated. Almost always, the novel idea includes a negative insight, the recognition that some previously accepted principle is wrong and must be discarded. And that creates, and this is something I'm familiar with as a teacher of design, it creates tremendous uncertainty. And because I see that in my students, and dwelling on that uncertainty is very important, as the romantic poet John Keats noted when he spoke about negative capability. That is when man is capable of being in uncertainties, mysteries, doubts, without any irritable reaching after fact and reason. And what I see happening when you realize that there's something that you thought you knew but you don't know is that you're then stuck with what's in front of you. And it actually induces a kind of attentiveness, which the great teacher Nadia Boulanger said was necessary. Attentiveness was necessary to be a musician. But she also said, if I remember correctly, because I read her writings many years ago and can't find it, that attentiveness was something that could not be taught. And this is where I disagree. I think it can. And as the great Stoic philosopher Epictetus said, it is impossible for a man to begin to learn that which he thinks he knows. So that whole process of undoing what you thought you know, the attentiveness to what's in front of you, really makes you in a great position for discovery, which I believe is the true foundation of learning, or for me, teaching, that you must discover it for yourself. And that's what I do. This is that first year class that Jerry mentioned. It's called The Making of Design Principles. This is the studio at RISD on the first day of class. And this is it towards the last day of class. And I'll run you through one problem that's no longer given, but we've used this philosophy in the way that we structure the curriculum for this class. It always starts with a little bit of inspiration, because I know that we're going to do some on learning, and the inspiration is the fuel to get you through this difficult uncertainty that you're going to encounter. So each student had a biological slide and microscope, and they were asked to sketch what they see, the order, the structure that they see. And they did. We gave them 1,000 wooden sticks, vinyl tubing. This was a student who was looking at a feather in their microscope. And I don't know what this was, but this is another example of hundreds of solutions. And then we did something which involved material. And I really love the word that artists use for material, that word medium, which is very important. It's one of the tools that you can use as a teacher for producing this kind of unlearning and then discovery. You know, artists use this word. They refer to it as something that goes in between. You know, it refers to medium and a process, but it goes between. And it also is something that can transmit, like a medium in a seance. And it's very often it goes between the preconceived idea and the revealed idea. So we gave the students a difficult material, very difficult material, which is this piano wire. It's very stubborn. It doesn't do what you want it to do. Piano wire and vinyl tubing. And we said, OK, you're going to rebuild those objects you just saw out of wood and vinyl, but now you're going to use piano wire. But first, you must make a set of joints. So this is one student's set of joints, and this is another. And now you're going to make this structure that you observed, but using these joints and the lines of the wire itself. And the behavior and the structure that you're making is completely a product of these joints and the locations of the joints and the wire. And they made things like this that were incredibly inventive. Like, this is a structure that's made out of bundles of 3 piano wires that are woven through each other and secured with a vinyl tube. And it allows something that can go from that top image above these 6 flat circles that then can extend up to 6 neighboring cylinders and then flatten out into a bundle. And the friction holds it at these different points along that way. Or these other structures that had the properties just through those joints and the location of the wires of this kind of spongy material. It was almost like they were making a material, like the material that they observed initially in the slides. They were making their own kind of DNA and structure through those joints and the wire. This had a kind of accordion folding property. And then we changed material again to transform this now into paper. And at the same time, we asked the students, ask yourself, what could these be? And they came up with structural ideas. They came up with ideas for envelopes of buildings. These are beginning students. And you can see these fragments of architecture that started to appear, ideas about structure, about space, about letting light in, about skin, the envelope. And that all came from that process. The next stage that I think is very important is I call it problem making. So it's not just problem solving. I think you have to define and make the problem. And sometimes out of a problem that doesn't exist yet, you have to recognize one. Because in doing that, you're already setting the direction of the solution in the way you frame, the way you define it, the way you identify it. But for me, problem making arises out of that absence that you found, the absence of the received idea or preconception. There's suddenly something that you thought you knew that's no longer there. And to me, that exactly that thing, the way you define that, is the impulse of the new need to know. And it is the beginning of the new problem. The American poet and teacher Richard Hugo spoke about the creative act containing and feeds off its own impulse, and that it's difficult and speculative to relate that impulse to any one thing other than itself. So it really is that you are authoring. And you must own that impulse. It's not something that can be given to you, I don't believe. It's something that you have to author. And that, as I say here, is what you need to know is the real problem within the problem that you might have been given. Now, this is when something happens, and it's very quick. I call it fielding, but it's where you start to notice things, a bunch of ideas, kind of associative logic. Maybe it's the firing of that electrical storm that David Eagleton talked about. And this is the moment where you capture what's in play. And one of my favorite examples of this is Richard Feynman. I don't know if anyone has read this or heard his description of this plate in Cornell, just seeing someone spinning it around and what it charged in his own mind. I was in the cafeteria and some guy fooling around throws a plate in the air. As the plate went up in the air, I saw it wobble and I noticed the medallion of Cornell on the plate going around. It was pretty obvious to me that the medallion went around faster than the wobbling. I had nothing to do, so I started figuring out the motion of the rotating plate. I discovered that when the angle is very slight, the medallion rotates twice as fast as the wobble rate. I went on to work out equations for wobbles. Then I thought about how the electron orbits start to move in relativity. Then there's the Dirac equation in electrodynamics, and then quantum electrodynamics. And before I knew it, the whole business that I got the Nobel Prize for came from piddling around with that wobbling plate. I think that's a great description because it really is like this pinball in a pinball machine just bouncing around. That impulse sort of, it's like an electrical charge connecting a lot of things. And so it's not enough to have this kind of capturing. It also must be, you know, framed, which is defining the limits of what is included. We all know about this kind of brain teaser. This is where you're asked to take the 9 dots and connect them with 4 lines without lifting your pen off the page. Now, the trick here is that when we see this, we have this imagined box, right, which is what the 9 dots define. But the only way to solve this problem is to escape the box, which is what this is showing, why our perceived limits of a problem are so critical, because you can miss exactly the solution. But it's not just the bracketing, which, you know, these hands are showing in that previous brain teaser, or the thoroughness. That's another way you can define a problem. How small are the openings in the net in terms of what fish you're going to catch, or what's the resolution? It goes beyond that. I mean, I think it is the relationships of what's in play that you need to define. An example, I don't know that much about baseball, but I found out that the baseball diamond was something that was discovered through play. It wasn't something that was designed. It was discovered through play, through all the many, many innumerable factors that you can't even name. How hard can you hit a ball? How far can you throw something? How fast can you run? What about the sun in your eyes or the equipment or your will, the human will? I mean, there's so many factors going into play, but if you change the diamond, if you increase the distance between the pitcher's mound and home plate, the pitcher's going to have a harder time and the hitter's going to get a much higher success rate. And probably all the people are going to come up at bat and just keep running around getting runs and we're not going to get any outs. If you increase the space between the bases, there's going to be another problem. It's going to be very hard for the runner to get to the next base before the pitcher throws the ball. So that diamond is the perfect set of dimensions to keep things in play so that one team doesn't stay there all the time, nor do you just keep getting outs where it keeps getting turned over. And that's part of writing a problem, that you start to recognize the limits of what's in play. Now, this is an amazing woman named Katie Payne. She was a bioacoustics researcher at the Laboratory of Ornithology at Cornell. She went to the zoo and felt a vibration. And then what you're hearing now is the sped up tape of silence, something that we cannot hear because it's not audible by the human ear. So she felt vibrations, she went back to the lab, they sped up the tape, she discovered the language of elephants. And this is an example of fielding, being very precise about the scale by which you're examining what you're collecting. Because if she didn't sped up the tape, none of that would have been heard. And the knowledge, this whole institute that she founded of the Elephant Listening Project wouldn't have happened. And I'll get back to her later. But it also, just to show you where I'm coming from, this is an example of how we often get projects as architects. This is a space in Boston. The client is a restaurateur. He has a retail store as well. He said, this is what I want. The entry at the front, which is the bottom of the slide, a corridor, to take you to the back where the restaurant would be at night. But during the day in the front, I have a retail store, but we have to close that off so that my merchandise doesn't get stolen when it's not open and we go to the restaurant. So they present you this as a solution. This is here, this is there, this is there. But what we found is that there was a better solution. And it came from breaking open those boxes of those areas that the client saw. And so what you see here, I think I have a pointer, is this is these are arrangement of vitrines showing the retail store's merchandise during the day. And at night, they gather shut, creating a kind of space you can walk through to go through a lounge to the restaurant at night. And so I'll show you a video of how it works. We took advantage of the industrial structure in the building and hung from rails these glass vitrines that could part at night, and during the day they come apart like clamshells so you can see all the merchandise. And then the client was obsessed about tables that you put together and are wobbly. So we use those rails, but now instead of from the ceiling, from the floor, to put these two seats together to make different varying size tables. So that's an example of how we have to do this, what I'm talking about as well, like thinking outside of the box to get a new set of relationships of what's at play. Gathering and tracking. Gathering is very, very important. It's that process of filling the open space of what you thought you knew and you don't know. And I don't see it as benign, although a lot of people think of it as benign, that it's something that maybe someone else can do for you. It's known as different things to different people, like collecting evidence for a detective, staging for a contractor, field studies for a geologist, evaluation for a doctor, foraging or procuring for a chef, jotting for a poet, research for a scientist, sketching for an artist, or gathering string, which I find very interesting, for a reporter. There's actually this thing called gathering string, which is the act of picking up seemingly unconnected facts and figures that eventually support a thesis. And the other thing about gathering is that many fields and practices have a protocol that you just go about doing, but not all protocols fit each situation. And one of the best examples is this idea of a white coat syndrome. I don't know if anyone's heard of that. It's the hypertension that many people get when they see a doctor entering the room. So there's misinformation that's given. So it's very important how you gather, because you're beginning the process of structuring information. You're actually making a language out of it. And so if we go back to that gathering string, just thinking about the many different ways you could gather strings or make knots, the upper left through the purpose that a nautical sailor might have with knots, nautical knots, or the upper right, mathematical knots, or knots that cannot be, they're defined as knots that cannot be undone, or just a random tangle that you see over here, or the Inca talking knots, where they held information through the placement of the knots around this ring. So that I actually teach this. Students who are developing the thesis, I ask them to make gathered objects. And I define a gathered object as something that holds itself together. How it holds itself together is very, very important. And so like a gathered object would be this ball of string, so elegant. The way the elliptical spiraling holds on the previous passing layers of string. And that's all that's there to hold it together, is the way it's been made. And it's very simply made by an inclined spool that gathers up the strings as it rotates around. And that geometry, that logic, that continual thread that builds up that way is a very elegant geometry and structure and of structuring information as well. Now, I think this is related and maybe to intelligence. What I found, I liked looking at words, I liked looking at the etymology of words, and I found that if you look at intelligence, it comes down to inter, which means between, and legere, to gather. And gather is not, it's not really that surprising, because we use the word gather in a colloquial way. We say, I gather that you're tired because you just yawned and you've been up all night. We also have other ways of knowing, like I reckon in terms of counting or recounting a story. I see, ways of knowing through perception. I figure, shaping, or through numbers. I grasp at the intelligence of the hand, and I understand. These are all just common usages of ways of knowing. Now, through this process of gathering and structuring information, this is where the real idea or goal emerges in my mind. There may be an initial intention, but I think what's much more important is the new one that emerges through that work. So like the data points on a graph, there's a kind of idealized line or axis that it starts to indicate as the new intention or goal that needs to be tracked. And this is now getting to tracking. So tracking means to follow a particular course. It's the new, very precise intention that emerges. And it comes from the root trahere, the action of drawing along, or the act of drawing. And this is where we can learn from artists again how drawing functions for finding the intention or the precise goal in a project. The painter Alfred de Credico said, "Drawing allows for existence in a place of possibility between the present and the future where knowing and discovery collide and merge." So drawing is not really about only depicting that something that's pre-existing, but it's about finding. It's about discovering. And also the word abstract, which could be that way, the goal that you find could have a very abstract identity that's not concrete yet. It means, in terms of its etymology, ab, away, and draw. So in the word abstraction is drawing as well. And intentions are so important. When these real intentions are found, how empowering they are. As Deepak Chopra spoke about, inherent in every intention and desire is the mechanics for its fulfillment. Intention and desire in the field of pure potentiality have infinite organizing power. And when we introduce an intention in the fertile ground of pure potentiality, we put this infinite organizing power to work for us. So now we get to the stage propelling, which for me, the propelling of a storm, the propelling of the process of creativity, it almost has its own engine. And that, I think, has a lot to do with the language that you're forming. And it's not just every field has its language, but everyone can be creative within their field or develop their own language. Even there's words for a writer, sounds, tones, timbres for a musician, represented by notation, mathematics for a physicist, movement for a dancer. But even a surgeon has a language. This is a friend of mine, Frank R. Wilson, a neurologist, who spoke about the kind of language that he found existing in the operating room. He was working as an internist in the ER for a brain surgeon that had this adaptive snorkel device because he didn't want to contaminate the surgery site. So he had this breathing apparatus. And he stood there for hours, and no one could move for hours while the surgery was going on, and you couldn't communicate with language. So what happened was there was a kind of language that develops through signs or just through grabbing instruments and knowing the procedures. So Frank says, "What kind of language was this? I'd be tempted to call it a San Francisco dialect of mainstream operative neurosurgical sign language. No one invented this language, named it, or even considered it to be a language as such. It just came into being in this particular community where it thrived for a number of years and eventually became the principal operating room language of residents who trained on this particular team at this particular time." Now, I teach architecture. I am an architect. So I can tell you probably the most about, I dabble in trying to know a little bit about many things, which probably annoys a lot of people who know more about these things than me. But I can tell you a little bit about architecture. And the Spanish architect Antoni Gaudí really is a great example of many aspects of the creative process, but particularly in terms of the language that he developed. I mean, very few people know, this is Sagrada Familia in Barcelona, very few people know that Gaudí was given the commission of working on this Gothic cathedral that was already under construction. And instead of taking the plans and the existing stylistic elements and just continuing, he went deeply into what Gothic architecture was, which was an extraordinary period where stone, which is kind of a dumb material, it works in compression, which means you can just stick a stone on top of a stone. It likes piles. It doesn't want to be in tension. The Gothic architects found a way by placing the stone in the lines of the stress of the load being carried through gravity, that it could make it soar. It could make it liquid and make very tall arches that span. And so Gaudí, the way he took that existing project and looking into it, he developed his own language of model making. He made these structures that are called funicular models. And they're made out of cords and weights. They're quite large. And by hanging these cords and weights, he's finding something that acts in pure tension so that the stress follows the material. If you make these rigid and you invert it, you have a pure structural compressive arch. And so he modeled his projects like this by hanging these huge models out of cords and weights upside down, designing the building and then inverting it. And so when you look at the plans of his structure, you no longer see just columns, but you think of knots, and you think of the cords being cut through that define the space and the structure. And so what you see on the left is the photo of the top of the funicular model inverted, and then its corollary in terms of how it determined these tilted arches. You can see these columns in the center are tilted because they're tilted along the line of stress, just as these are, right? So it came directly out of that, and that was inventive. It wasn't just stylistic. Most of the cathedrals have these flying buttresses. But because he put all the stress in the lines of the material, they were unnecessary because the thrust was taken up. It was unnecessary to add the flying buttress. And so it was also very poetic. So while the heavens, you know, are pulling up the church when it's finally built, the way it was generated was the gravity was pulling the funicular models down. And so there was this analogous condition between the forces of how it was made and how it would eventually be understood. Perceiving and conceiving. Drawing from life is something I've done my whole life. It's a process of jumping from sensing something, perceiving it, and then conceptualizing in your head. These are some drawings when I was a student, but you're constantly looking, you understand it better, you bring that back into your conception of it and how you draw it. Another person who I think really does this activity very well is there's a whole group of stone balancers. One of them is Michael Grab, who has a work called Gravity Glue. But what's so beautiful is when you read how he describes what he's doing, he has to make those things balance. There's no glue, right? It's just the way finding the exact balance. So as Michael Grab says, he talks about the tripods. You know, every way that you balance these rocks, they have to find three points that it could balance on the next rock. By paying close attention to the vibrations of the rocks, you will start to feel even the smallest clicks as the notches of the rocks are moved over one another. In the finest point balances, these clicks can be felt on a scale smaller than millimeters. And in rare cases, they can even go undetected, in which case intuition and experience becomes quite useful. So this process of sensing, but then conceptualizing what's operating to then sense more is so important in all fields. This is something that some of you may have seen this. I'm going to give the punchline away. This is a selective attention test that I won't perform on you guys. But it's where you see these students in white shirts or in black shirts passing a basketball. And then the video says to you, count how many times those in the white shirt pass the basketball. And everyone does it very dutifully, paying attention. And then he says, how many times? And you answer it. And then he says, but did you notice the gorilla walking through the room? And most people never see the gorilla because you told yourself what you're looking for. And so you actually don't see the gorilla. So now you have to try it on others. You can find it, Daniel Simons, on YouTube, Selective Attention Test. Now, what's interesting is the author of this talks about it as revealing the faults of intuition. And I don't think that's quite right. I think it has more to do with preconceptions. If you tell yourself what you're looking for, that's what you see. It really affects what you see. And that's why getting rid of preconceptions are so important to make discoveries. Now, I'm going to tell you, this play between what you see and how you conceive it is really important for making a discovery from accidents. We all have heard about many major inventions and discoveries made accidentally. One of them is close to home. It's my father. He was the architect for Wallace K. Harrison, a firm in New York City that did big chunks of New York City. And one of the projects was Lincoln Center, the Metropolitan Opera House. And I'm going to tell you about how these came, the chandeliers in the Opera House came to be. So there's my dad and a draftsman in Wallace K. Harrison, and a sketch of the Opera House from the outside in Lincoln Center. And there's the one of the chandeliers that I'm going to tell you about. So my father was doing one of these drawings that you see, I showed you previously, for a meeting. Rockefeller was the client, hurriedly doing this. But at the same time, this was a significant moment in history where the first radio telescope was discovered. So it was the first time we saw physical proof of the Big Bang, because in between the stars, it wasn't black like the optical telescopes. There was this cosmic radiation that you could see, the glow that you see here. So that was a big deal. Finally, the Big Bang was tangible. It was in the air. Everyone was thinking about it. And so my father's doing a drawing like this, and in the middle of doing the drawing, rushing for, that happens. An ink drop falls right on the drawing. But the meeting's about to happen, so what do you do? Well, he added white to make it look like light coming from it so that it would appear to be a chandelier, and added more. And that became the design of the chandeliers. Now, that kind of connecting, there's lots of things going on here when these accidents happen. It has to do with what's happening in the world, because that's in your mind. That's what allows you to see certain things, not the gorilla or not the gorilla, right? And the accident provokes something that you otherwise would not have done, too, which is what brings about something new. There you see, they're in the central hall. They what's beautiful about them also is when you go to a opera, they rise as the curtain is opening, they go up and retract into the ceiling. Now, the other aspect about this perception, conception is it's very close to discovery. Perception is discovering something, and invention is the conception of something. And an example of that, there's a fine line between them. One of the examples I can think of is Torricelli with the invention of the barometer. He was trying to make a column of water, and they only could get so high. So he changed the fluid to be mercury, and he found if he inverted a tube filled with mercury on a basin of mercury, the mercury would drop slightly, and there'd be a vacuum at the top of the tube. But what he found, so that was a discovery, he found that the column of mercury would rise and fall based on atmospheric pressure. So there was a discovery about that, the properties of that column of mercury in a tube, but it also was at the same time the invention of the barometer. So there's a fine line between that observation, discovery, and invention. Seeing ahead, time travel. We see ahead, this is me, when we make designs that are materialized in the future, when we write problems that anticipate solutions, when we link one step of another in navigating our lives and the way through anything, especially the empty page, writer's block, confusion, chaos, needs, and questions. Now, the imagination is really key for this, for seeing ahead, because I think it's through the imagination you have an equal relationship to the real and the unreal. So it allows you to inhabit the future. And I love this quote from Lewis Carroll's Through the Looking Glass. It's the White Queen who says, "It's a poor sort of memory that only works backwards," the Queen remarks. So I thought, okay, what memory works forward? And that's the imagination. Now, to show you a little more of there's always these plenty of examples. You can find Smithsonian.com lists examples of inventions that first existed in science fiction, in that imaginative narrative play that a writer might have. You know, they can be the submarine, the rocket, atomic power, cell phone, helicopter, QuickTime, and many others can be traced back to very specific science fiction. But also, let me show you this one. This is a student, a project that I gave very, very early on in my teaching that had a big effect on me. I gave this painting to a group of students called Polyphonically Enclosed White by Paul Klee. It's about this big. And I asked them to, using white museum board and white glue, to build the third dimension. And one student, John Schroeder, made this, and he was very, very intent on doing this. He had a system. Yellow was a certain height of tube. Blue was another height of tube. I asked him why. He couldn't tell me, but this is what he wanted to do. So he worked very hard. He made this object. It has a white base, museum board, these white tubes of different heights that match the view for the painting from above. And when he was done in the morning, he lifted it up to the north light coming into the building at RISD. And this is what he saw. Now, this is taken, this is an unaltered scan, we have to scan because it's digital, of a Kodachrome slide. So the colors are slightly more intense than they were, but that's what it did. He didn't know that it was going to do that, but that's what it does. It refracts the light in this way. And watching that kind of deliberateness in the student really taught me something about, you know, sort of allowing this kind of internal process that's happening to let it run its course, because that sometimes there's something emerging from the unconscious that someone is understanding but can't yet consciously name. It made me also think about Paul Klee, who is an artist in the Bauhaus, and there was probably many things that look like this at the Bauhaus. So in fact, he may have been in some way channeling an object that was built at the Bauhaus by some student that Paul Klee saw and then painted. So that's another aspect of this time travel that I'm talking about. It can go forward or backwards, which brings you to this project that we did, 360, a chapel for a church, which had to be, I'll just tell you this little story, part accident. The church had this steeple that you see here that you buy in a catalog and they stick it on the church. We didn't do the original church. We were asked to do this addition that you see here. And the steeple kept falling off our model, and I thought, what is this steeple? What is going on? You know, it's a spire, and then there's the steeple. What does it mean? So I looked up spire, and it comes from spiral, and there's spiral, and spirare, which is spirit, and inspire, and respire. And that related to what the parish wanted. They wanted more breathing room. They wanted the space to breathe more. And it was also a religious space that was also multifunctional. So this that root of spiral, spirare, of something that's always expanding and contracting like breath. And the footprint of the church had to be this trapezoid, which I can't go into now why. But we were just basically trying to figure out how to structure this thing. And what we found is that if you kept the structure true to each side, that it would spiral around, almost creating it, without creating a separate spire, it created this spiraling around in the space that set the structure, the acoustic fins, and the windows for the space. But so that seemed to make a lot of sense because it achieved what they were asking for. But we also found, this is another view, these two images of prior churches, the parishes that joined to form that church that you saw many years ago. And it seemed like one church had its structure poking through the skin and had this concave roof, whereas this one is, the structure is sealed up. And it almost reminded me of the church, the two chapels. One was breathing in, revealing the rib cage, and one was breathing out. So it was almost like its historical roots were in what we did as well. How am I doing on time? Getting close. Okay, so connecting, I will skip this about the storm. Steve Jobs defines basically creativity as connecting things. And probably the greatest connector that I can think of in the world is Darwin. And what's astounding to me about Darwin's theory of natural selection is that there were just these three principles that were there for everyone to see. You didn't need any special tool, you didn't need any kind of telescope or any equipment to augment your own ability to recognize these things. The three things: overpopulation, that organisms produce more offspring than survive; variation, that traits vary within a species; and inheritance, that traits or variations of traits are carried from one generation to the next. That's it. So when you look into natural selection, that's all there is, that he made a connection between these three things that set everything in motion, that changed everything from then on. I think I'm going to skip this story since we don't have, we're running out of time, right? We're running out of time? It's okay? Okay. Okay, so I will tell you this story. This is a very important step, sleeping on it, taking a break, maybe a death, maybe a pause where a creative practice is put on hold and is picked up by someone else. Any scale of stopping a process, I actually think is very important. It's sort of analogous to that unlearning that takes place that I spoke about earlier. So one of the best examples is this engineer, Joseph Woodland, who was asked, he was at Drexel University, he was asked, working with Bernard Silver, asked by a supermarket chain to come up with something that you could put on all objects so that it could identify the object, which became known as the barcode, is what he invented. But they worked on it for years. They couldn't come up with anything. He gave up. He went to his parents' home in Florida. He sat on the beach. He stuck his fingers in the sand, and he drew them close to him. And he saw something like that. And he thought some lines could be thick, some lines could be thin. The spacing could vary, and you could basically code something. And the reason why he knew that is because he had studied Morse code as a Boy Scout. And so he could recognize in those lines the capacity for coding. But this is there's many examples of this idea of someone taking a break. There's a mathematician who put his foot on a bus and he came up with an idea. There's many examples of how a pause could allow perhaps this kind of relaxed state to have things percolate up that you've been working on that you're then prepared to recognize because of your work or because of your past experiences, like you see here with the Morse code. And finally, continuing is just the continuing of the cycle. And I'll skip this. This is about the storm. But a little tidbit. I painted my dreams for 2 years. And I have 250 paintings. And I did them just so I could recognize them quickly, as opposed to writing something. And so I really believe that out of this depth, ideas can come, and they very much do percolate up after a pause. But I want to tell you a story. I won't tell you about this, but I'll tell you a story about going back to Katy Payne. I met Katy Payne. I saw a video, I think it was a 60 Minutes and a documentary on her. She's the woman who discovered that elephants speak. And she was kind of a hero of mine. I thought it was amazing what she did. But I gave a talk at, as Jerry spoke about, at PopTech in 2009, and I was preparing for my talk in the dining room of a hotel. It was empty because everyone was at this talk and I wasn't. I was trying to get ready. And Katy Payne, who was also one of the speakers, came over to my table and said, "Can I sit down?" And I said, "Yes." But I was very quiet because she was my hero. And she started to tell me about a book called Three Cups of Tea. I think it's written by Greg Mortensen. And I won't go into the whole story, but the three cups of tea signify this society's practice of the first cup of tea means you're a friend, the second cup of tea means you're family, and the third cup of tea means you would give your life for that person. So she told that story about that book. And then she went on to tell me this story, which she said, I can only tell you about if I quote it exactly from her book, so I will read it now. She had a dream. That night that she discovered the elephants had a sound that we couldn't hear, she was exhausted, she went home, she immediately fell asleep, and this was her dream. I was lying in a deep, damp, warm, grassy sward in the faint light of pre-dawn. Close, in fact, looming over me was a swaying, silent circle of elephants. They were large and small, and several were reaching out with their trunks to sniff me where I lay, tiny and helpless. They swayed hugely, breathing over me for a long time, and then the largest female spoke in a voice that I heard the way you can sometimes hear in a dream, without vocal features, language, or sound. The elephant spoke, "We did not reveal this to you, so you would tell other people." I lay silent, holding my breath, waiting for more, but there was only the sound of the elephants breathing and their strange eyes looking down, down and down on me. At the very bottom of all those trunks and all those gazes with the serious, inscrutable expression that I associate uniquely with elephants. So she told me that dream, and then she said, "You know, Kina, I've always been very distraught by this dream because the elephants told me, we did not reveal this to you so that you would tell other people. But I've taken this knowledge about the elephant's language, which quite she's developed in a huge way. She now observes elephants in Africa with their social behaviors. There's funerals that the elephants hold. It's not just semantics. There's syntax to their language. It's a highly developed language. She actually used to study whale songs before studying the elephants. She said, but I told people, I didn't follow the advice here. And because she had just told the story about the book, The Three Cups of Tea, I said, no, Katie, you misunderstood what that meant. It doesn't mean that we did not reveal this to you so that you would tell other people. They're not telling you not to tell other people. They're saying that's not the reason why we told you. We told you because of the three cups of tea. We told you because you gave your life to us and we give our life to you. And that really, really affected her. And I know that this study that she did really, she felt deep empathy for the elephants. That now her institute not only records elephants in Africa, but they an empty sound and what we can't hear in Africa, but you know, they study the sounds after they speed it up. But she's now an advocate for the elephants, and she found a number of the elephants that they were studying were being slaughtered or culling. And so she feels this empathy for it and responsibility. And I have a friend who's a poet who taught me that the word responsibility means being able to respond. Responsibility. So the reason why I'm telling you all this is because I have questions about empowering people, you know, through my students trying to empower people with creativity. Because can you start something that's unethical? Can you start something that's highly destructive? Can that propelling process, if you find the way to enter into the process that you produce something that actually can be very destructive? Probably yes. I mean, storms are destructive. But I think if you occupy that place that she so well does, that's connected still to your own nature and your own innate intelligence and the product of the worlds, the culture in the worlds, the science, the branches of knowledge that already exists. And then beyond that, the nature that we all are living in, I think you not only become responsible and being able to respond to the problems, but I think you also develop, you can't help but feel empathy for them. And that's where I'd like to leave this. Thank you.